This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. What if comparing car insurance rates was as easy as putting on your favorite podcast? With Progressive, it is. Just visit the Progressive website to quote with all the coverages you want. You'll see Progressive's direct rate. Then their tool will provide options from other companies so you can compare. All you need to do is choose the rate and coverage you like. Quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Comparison rates not available in all states or situations. Prices vary based on how you buy.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone. We can know something of a nation by the conduct of its police. This week saw moments of patience and compassion from the police in some cities, but other police departments presented brutally in the unblinking eyes of cell phone cameras. On Tuesday, the LA Police Commissioner held a Zoom call to hear from constituents.
Police chief, you gotta resign. There's just no way around it. Like, you look so smug listening to everybody talking, and it's shameful.
Tear gas is not even allowed to be used in war. Why is it being used on Los Angeles citizens? Helicopters have been over our neighborhood for days like we're criminals. Your department is violating human rights.
On Wednesday, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti announced that he'd be scrapping plans for a hike to the LAPD's $1.8 billion budget and instead would be cutting $100 to $150 million from it. In Minneapolis, Ward 3 Representative Stephen Fletcher called for totally reimagining what public safety means and what is really needed and really not needed.
At some point, we have to look at, you know, what actually is going to get to the root cause.
We can trace the roots of American policing all the way to the antebellum South.
So a white civilian has the power to arrest and detain any black person seen outside of the control of their master. And in the southern states, these groups of white men organize what's known as slave patrols to assist slaveholders.
Slave patrols, says Yale University historian Elizabeth Hinton, were the precursors to the forces patrolling American streets today. But we wouldn't see the birth of formal police departments until the mid-19th century.
You get your first what looks like modern police forces in cities like New York and Boston. They are tasked with protecting the property of elites and also stamping out labor unrest. And so there's a lot of police violence that accompanies this protection of state and private property.
How did that evolve by, say, the middle of the 20th century?
So I don't know how much it has evolved. I think that from the colonial period and the founding of this country, the impulse of policing has been to protect property, to enforce social control and maintain a social order, immigrants, communities of color, and laboring communities.
It seems to contrast a lot with what the media representations of the police were. I mean, by the 50s, there was Dragnet.
Los Angeles, California. I work here. I'm a cop.
The motto, to protect and to serve, was adopted by the LAPD in 1955. It was later picked up around the country. But I'm going to assume that this wasn't bought by everyone.
Right. So for white and middle class people, the primary duty of police is to protect and serve, is to guard property, is to keep those communities safe from undesirable, scare quote, outsiders. For low income people, for people of color in particular, policing is about surveillance, social control, searching for suspects, and making arrests.
Those people weren't being depicted getting harassed on Dragnet.
What's really key about the Dragnet moment and the 1950s moment is this is when we really begin to see a new kind of dedication of resources to law enforcement, new uniforms, the kind of swelling of the ranks of officers themselves, along with new tactics. This professionalization coincides, of course, with the Great Migration of African Americans from the southern states to the north. So, you know, one could actually trace the buttressing of police departments alongside the rise of black populations in the urban north.
So let's move from the 50s to Johnson's War on Crime in 1965. The Great Migration is really winding down. You see this as the biggest transformation of policing in American history, right?
We have to go a little bit before Johnson to the Kennedy administration, when Kennedy and other officials became really concerned about growing populations of Black youth between the ages of 15 and 24, living in cities that were becoming majority Black or close to a third Black. And they said, if we don't make some kind of intervention, this social dynamite, that's what they called this group of youth, would explode. So they established a major anti-delinquency program, pre-kindergarten programs that become Head Starts, job training programs, social workers doing outreach with youth who were vulnerable to violence. This was Kennedy's attempt to really wrestle with these problems. In 1964, Harlem does explode. Johnson immediately labeled this uprising as criminal. He took strides to separate it from the nonviolent direct action protests of the civil rights movement, even though the grievances that caused the Harlem community to erupt were rooted in socioeconomic conditions, much like civil rights protests. The following year, as a prevention measure, Johnson declared the war on crime in March 1965.
To provide better training and better pay for police, to bring the most advanced technology to the war on crime in every city and every county in America.
And of course, absent a real fundamental change to political and economic realities, the social dynamite continued to explode every summer of Johnson's presidency. And as they did, policymakers dedicated greater amounts of resources to fighting the war on crime and pulled back from the war on poverty as the turmoil of the 60s continued to unfold.
I think that you would see as the greatest missed opportunity the brief moment of a policy that called for, quote, maximum feasible participation.
Yes. The principle that steered the early development of the war on poverty programs was this idea, which is poor people, better than outsiders, you know, should be empowered to change their own community on their own terms. And so really only in the first year of the Office of Economic Opportunities operation, between the Harlem Uprising of 1964 and the Watts Los Angeles Uprising of 1965, the federal government was funding autonomous grassroots organizations directly. One of the preeminent programs that received these funds was the Mobilization for Youth program in New York City's Lower East Side. Organizers organized their fellow residents to do things like protest City Hall, to engage in rent strikes against slum landlords. In Syracuse, the Community Development Corporation got the city to fund recreational facilities for youth. These grassroots organizations registered people to vote. You know, these programs really did foster an exciting and inspiring level of community empowerment and mobilization. One of the things that was so frustrating is that funding a tenant organization is like 1/50th the cost of funding a SWAT team. And policymakers knew that these kinds of measures were really effective at reducing crime. And yet, these community-based measures were defunded and dissolved way too quickly.
We will spin fast through the Nixon years, where he dismantled the remnants of Johnson's war on poverty. At the end, only about 2% of the grants the Justice Department dispersed to fight the war on crime went to community-based measures like tenant patrols and block watches. And then the era of Ronald Reagan and the broken windows policy that we associate with a generation later. That's where it began.
Right, 1982, the idea of broken windows is influenced by the criminologists George Kelling and James Q. Wilson. The strategy is if you arrest people for minor offenses, you will be essentially preventing people from engaging in more serious and potentially violent crime. The thing that happens alongside this new zero tolerance policing strategy is the criminalization of drug abuse, which now is discussed increasingly as a public health crisis in the context of the opioid epidemic. These two strategies really escalated the criminalization of entire communities that policymakers were simultaneously divesting from. Reagan cuts tens of thousands of people from the food stamp rolls. And of course, this trend continues through the 1990s and through the Clinton administration, cuts the school lunch programs, which we continue to see today, while amping up police to fight the war on drugs. Again, another really failed strategy to keep communities safe, especially if we believe that many of these problems of crime and violence are rooted in socioeconomic conditions.
Let's talk about the militarization of the police.
2014 in Ferguson was really a watershed moment.
The police were, as you said, using tear gas. They were heavily armed. Their weapons were drawn. They used
the public face. Really saw those big Hummer vehicles mm-hmm. that the Ferguson police were using to stamp out protests, AK-47s. And a lot of people attributed this to the transfers from the military to civilian police that began during the war on terror. But again, history tells us that these kinds of transfers were going on for some time, that they began mm-hmm. really in the context of Vietnam.
They didn't know what to do with all that stuff.
And they were also fighting a war at home. Urban uprisings were very real. These kind of militarized tactics was really first used as a strategy to stamp out the radical left, so groups like the Weather Underground, and Black militants and revolutionaries like the Black Panther Party and the Black mm-hmm. Liberation Army. These tactics end up becoming the foremost strategies that are used in the war on drugs.
And then later in the third millennium?
One of the things that has changed is that this militarization is not just about the LAPD and the NYPD. It's about smaller police departments like Ferguson. Like, what is this small city doing with these Hummers that are used in Iraq? And with the kind of militarization in hardware comes, again, this kind of warrior mentality. So it has a material manifestation, but also how officers increasingly see themselves. Many officers today, you know, have been in the Army and have served our country and come home and bring that training to the ways in which they police residents on the street.
So now we're hearing a call from protesters taking the streets, defund the police. The U.S. spends about $100 billion annually on policing. L.A. is a prime example. 17.5% of its total budget of $10.5 billion is reserved for the police. 53.8% of the city's unrestricted general fund. Americans have made police the primary problem-solving institution in our society. If you have a morals objection to sex work or drug use, send the police. If we have a mental health issue or people are homeless, send the police. What would a radical shrinking of police forces mean?
We can go back to those early models of American policing where people were responsible for keeping their own community safe. So this schools that don't have police officers in full uniforms with guns walking around and metal detectors and security, that's going to look like tenant patrols and block watch associations. That's going to have to accompany a major investment in resources in that community. But fundamentally, so much of what is involved in police duties today should really not be part of police work. Officers aren't trained to be social workers and counselors. The mental health example is a really good one. You know, as a result, people who need a different set of resources are treated punitively. And part of the conversation is really redefining public safety. Does public safety mean that somebody who jumps a turnstile gets arrested and put in jail, which costs taxpayers thousands of dollars? Or does public safety mean that every child in America has access to clean water? Now is the time to rethink what kind of a nation do we want to be? And that's going to require not only a change in worldview, but a major redistribution of resources and a kind of seeding of power and disruption of the racial hierarchies mm-hmm. that have really defined the United States since its founding.
Elizabeth, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me. This is a great conversation.
Elizabeth Hinton is a professor of history, African American studies, and law at Yale University and author of From the War on Poverty to the War on Crime, The Making of Mass Incarceration in America. Coming up, the question of whether humanity deserves what it's wrought. This is On the Media.
WNYC Studios is supported by the Community of Writers, presenting live online short courses in the Writers' Annex. Upcoming in 2024, Sylvia Plath, James Joyce's Ulysses, and Emily Dickinson. Instructors include Victoria Chang, Robert Haas, Brenda Hillman, Peter Orner, and Matthew Zapruder. Learn more at communityofwriters.org.